Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Susan Shand. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
When Cambodia first began offering COVID-19 vaccinations, people waited in long lines. But 3 months into its campaign, just 11% of Cambodia's population had received at least one vaccine dose. In Japan, it took 2 weeks longer to reach that level. Now, both countries have vaccination rates that are among the world's best. The Asian countries with high rates include rich and poor nations. Some are big and some are small, but all have experience with infectious diseases. The viral disease related to COVID-19, SARS, caused an outbreak in 2002. The Asian countries with high vaccination rates also chose to order vaccines from several different manufacturers. Most of the highly vaccinated Asian countries started offering shots later than other places, including the United States. By the time the nations started injecting their citizens, countries like the US, Britain, and India were reporting rising numbers of deaths. That helped to get people who had doubts to get vaccinated.
Cambodia was one of the earlier countries in the Asia-Pacific area to start its vaccination program. It launched its effort on February 10th. That was still 2 months after the United States and Britain began theirs. The effort began slowly. By early May, the Delta variant, a new version of the virus, was spreading quickly around the world. At the time, just 11% of Cambodia's 16 million people had gotten their first shot, Our World in Data reported. During the first 3 months of the United States offering vaccines, about 20% of the population had gotten their first shot. But today, Cambodia is 78% fully vaccinated, compared to 58% in the United States. From the beginning, Cambodia has seen strong demand for the vaccine. Prime Minister Hun Sen used his close ties with China to order nearly 37 million doses from China, some of which were donated. Cambodia also received large donations from the US, Japan, Britain, and from the international COVAX program. Still, it took time to get enough supplies. Many other Asian countries that started their programs later struggled even more. The problems increased when India, the region's major vaccine producer, suspended vaccine exports.
Many Asian countries put in place extreme stay-at-home measures and travel rules that kept the virus numbers low. But when the Delta variant began spreading through the region, cases rose quickly, and people signed up to get vaccinated. Malaysia made extra efforts to make sure that all groups were offered the vaccine. With the help of the Red Cross, it gave shots to people living in the country illegally and other groups that may have feared showing up for a government-supported vaccination. We made the vaccine accessible to all, with no questions asked, said Sazali Abubakar. He is director of the Tropical Infectious Diseases and Research Education Center in Malaysia. Malaysia started slowly. In the first 3 months, it gave less than 5% of its 33 million people their first dose. Then case numbers started rising. Malaysia acted by buying more doses and establishing hundreds of vaccination centers. It set up centers able to provide up to 10,000 shots in one day. Today, 76% of Malaysia's population is fully vaccinated. Many other countries in the Asia-Pacific area also have vaccination rates close to or above 70%. They include Australia, China, Japan, and Bhutan. In Singapore, 92% are fully vaccinated. Some countries in Asia, however, have continued to struggle. India celebrated giving its billionth COVID-19 vaccine dose in October. But the country has over 1.4 billion people. With two doses needed, that means only 29% of the population is fully vaccinated.
Japan's vaccine program was especially slow in its early months. Many people around the world wondered how it would be able to hold the Summer Olympics, which opened in July. Japan did not start offering vaccines until the middle of February because it required additional testing on Japanese people. The move was widely criticized as unnecessary. But then it started making progress. Then Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga brought in military medical workers to operate big vaccination centers in Tokyo and Osaka. It eased laws to let dentists, emergency workers, and laboratory workers give shots in addition to doctors and nurses. Japan is now about 76% fully vaccinated. Many in Japan express doubt about vaccines in general. But after death numbers rose sharply around the world, many put their doubts aside. Retiree Kiyoshi Goto is already seeking a booster shot. "I want to get a booster shot as our antibody levels are going down," the 75-year-old said. And in Phnom Penh, Nuth Nira was happy. The 5-year-old said she was fearful of COVID-19 before, but not anymore. "I felt a little bit of pain when I got the shot," the young girl said. "But I didn't cry." I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm John Russell.
School girls are staying home almost everywhere in Afghanistan because Taliban rulers will not permit them to go to school. There is, however, one exception. For weeks, girls in the western province of Herat have been back in high school classrooms. This comes after an effort by teachers and parents to work with the local Taliban administrators to reopen the schools. Taliban officials never officially approved the reopening, but they also did not stop it when classes started in early October. Parents, students, and teachers joined hand in hand to do this, said Mohammed Sabir Mashal. He is the head of the Herat Teachers Group, which helped organize the campaign. The success in Herat shows the difference in the Taliban's current rule over Afghanistan from their rule in the late 1990s. In their earlier rule, the Taliban banned women from public life and would not permit girls to attend school. They used force and punishments to enforce the rules. Now, the Taliban seem to understand that they cannot act the same way. In the past 20 years, Afghanistan has changed. Women are out in public, and some have professional lives. The Taliban have been unclear about what is permitted and what is not permitted. Many think the Taliban do not want to create additional problems as they try to get control of an economy that is near collapse. The group also faces the possible loss of international financial support and the dangerous growth of the Islamic State in the country. That has left a narrow path where Afghans can try to push back. When the Taliban took power in August, most schools were closed because of COVID-19. Following international pressure, the Taliban soon reopened schools for girls in grades 1 through 6, along with boys' schools at all levels. They have not permitted girls in grades 7 through 12 to return, saying they must be certain the classes are held in an Islamic manner. The Taliban also barred most women from government jobs, their largest place of employment. I'm Susan Shand.
Consider the words building, window, and garden. What do all of them have in common? Now consider the words produce, succeed, and employ. These two have something in common. You will learn the answers to these questions in today's report. In this Everyday Grammar, we will explore the link between grammar and pronunciation. You will learn about how Americans pronounce nouns and verbs that have two syllables. Let's start with a few important ideas and terms. A noun is the name of something, a person, place, thing, or idea. Building, window, and garden are three examples. A verb is a word that expresses an action or state of being. Common verbs include like, want, be, or think. You heard three other verbs at the beginning of the report: produce, succeed, and employ. The final terms you should know about are syllable and stress. A syllable is any one of the parts into which a word is divided when it is spoken. A syllable generally has a vowel, or a vowel and one or more consonant sounds. Stress means saying something louder or in a higher pitch. Let's consider some examples that include these ideas. Consider the noun ball. It has one syllable. Consider the noun computer. It has three syllables. Computer. In longer words, Americans generally stress one syllable more than other syllables. This is part of what makes American English sound like it does. In our example about the word computer, the stress is on the middle part of the word, pew. Computer. Computer. Now, you might be asking yourself about the connection between syllables, verbs, and nouns. The answer is this. Americans generally stress two-syllable verbs and nouns in regular ways. Syllable stress is important for showing the difference in meaning. For the purposes of today's report, we will explore nouns and verbs with two syllables. Longer words are a bit more complicated. Consider these two words, produce and produce. The first word, produce, is a noun. It means food, such as fruits or vegetables. So, a person might say,
I love that store. It has such lovely produce.
Note that in the noun produce, the stress is on the first syllable of the word. Now let's consider produce, the verb. It means to make something. A person might say,
That company produces 1,000 cars every year.
Note that in the verb produce, the stress is on the second syllable of the word. The general idea is that in words with two syllables, nouns have stress on the first syllable, and verbs have stress on the second syllable. We started this report with a question. Consider the words building, window, and garden. What do all of them have in common? The answer is that these words are all nouns that have two syllables. They also have stress on the first syllable. Now consider the words produce, succeed, and employ. These are all verbs with two syllables. They all have stress on the second syllable. In today's report, we explored one of the points of connection between grammar and pronunciation. The next time you want to pronounce an unusual English word, ask yourself if it is a noun or a verb. If you can tell if the word is a noun or verb, then you have a better chance at guessing the correct syllable stress. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In March of 1868, Congress tried to remove President Andrew Johnson from office. But the Senate failed in the effort by one vote. Andrew Johnson was a Democrat. Congress was controlled by radical members of the Republican Party. Most of the charges at Johnson's trial were based on his dismissal of the Secretary of War. A new law said the president could not remove a cabinet officer without Senate approval. Johnson said the law was unconstitutional. The trial was an important turning point in the making of the nation. Removal from office would have established the idea that the president could serve only with the approval of Congress. The president would have become, in effect, a prime minister, requiring the support of Congress to remain in office. Andrew Johnson's victory kept alive the idea of an independent presidency. Although Congress failed to remove him, the vote did not end a conflict with the White House over the future of the South. But it did have an effect on efforts to rebuild the South following the war. Radical Republicans wanted to punish the South for starting the war. They also wanted to be sure new governments in the southern states would support the Republican Party. Doug Johnson and Frank Oliver tell about the Reconstruction of the South.
One way radical Republicans gained support was by helping give blacks the right to vote. They knew former slaves would vote for the party which had freed them. Another way Republicans kept control in the South was by preventing whites from voting there. They passed a law saying no Southerner could vote if he had taken part in the rebellion against the Union. This prevented the majority of Southern whites from voting for Democrats and against Republicans.
Congress also made strong rules about what Southern states had to do to re-enter the Union. It said each of the states needed a new constitution that protected the voting rights of all black men. And it said each Southern state must approve an amendment to the United States Constitution that gave citizenship to blacks. The radicals did not rest with changes in the law. They also sent their supporters south to organize blacks for the Republican Party. Many Southern whites hated these men from the North. They had a special name for them. Carpetbaggers. The name arose because many of the Northerners who went south arrived with all their possessions in a carpet handbag. Southerners also had a name for their own people who cooperated with the carpetbaggers. They called them scalawags. Neither name was friendly.
Southern whites had a reason to be bitter. They had lost the Civil War. Now much of their power was gone, and they were suffering. But there was another side to the story as well. Southern whites had held black people in slavery for many years. Now the former slaves were getting to enjoy a small taste of freedom. Also, the South had started the Civil War, which had caused so much death and destruction. It was not surprising that the North showed little sympathy when the fighting stopped and the South lay in ruins. Southern states organized conventions to form new governments. Soon, all but three Southern states had new legislatures. Not surprisingly, radical Republicans held firm control in every one of the new governments. Many of the new governors and state officials were carpetbaggers from outside the state. Others were Southern scalawags.
Many of these new state officials were dishonest. They began using their power to become rich. In South Carolina, for example, the new governor was a former army officer from the state of Ohio. He gave government jobs to many dishonest men, including some who were wanted for crimes in other states. The same situation existed in other state governments in the South. In Louisiana, for example, the governor was a carpetbagger from the state of Illinois. He left office after 4 years with $1 million. His official pay during that time was only $32,000.
The South was not the only place where public officials were dishonest. The period after the Civil War in the United States was marked by several famous incidents involving violations of the public trust. Some of these incidents took place in the North, even in the White House. They were among the worst examples of dishonesty and poor government ever to take place in American history. It also is important to note that not everyone in the South was dishonest. The new state governments did many good things. They built roads and bridges, schools and hospitals. They improved transportation and education. They loaned money to companies to build railroads. Most important, they helped give hope to former slaves. These people were struggling to create a new life in the land of their former owners.
So the record of Reconstruction in the South was mixed. Many Southerners believe, even today, that Reconstruction was a bitter time of defeat. But others now say this period after the Civil War was a necessary step in creating a different kind of South from the one which had existed before. Historians do agree that Reconstruction changed the United States in several important ways. One of the most important changes was in the Constitution. Congress passed three historic amendments to the Constitution during this period.
The first was the 13th Amendment. It ended slavery in the United States. The next was the 14th Amendment. It said, all persons born or naturalized in the United States were citizens of the United States and of the state in which they lived. It said no state could limit the rights of these citizens. Finally, there was the 15th Amendment. It said, a citizen of the United States could not be prevented from voting because of his color. The 13th Amendment freed all Negro slaves. The 14th and 15th Amendments were supposed to protect their rights. These laws alone, however, did not succeed in doing this. It would take another century until Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders to make these rights a reality. Yet the passage of these three amendments to the Constitution was still a historic step in making blacks full and equal citizens.
These same laws and other actions of the radical Republicans changed the South in other, less desirable ways. They helped cause angry whites to form the Ku Klux Klan and other groups that terrorized blacks for years to come. The laws also increased bitterness between the North and South that lasted many years. Reconstruction changed the economy of the South, too. White landowners broke up their big farms into smaller pieces of land. They rented these to black farmers. With the land came seed, tools, and enough supplies for a year. In exchange for this, the owner would get a large share of the crop raised by the tenant farmer. This system, called sharecropping, spread through the South. It lasted for almost 100 years. Sharecropping made it possible for blacks to work the land for themselves for the first time in their lives. But it also made it difficult for them to earn enough money to improve their condition. As a result, the majority of Southern blacks remained in poverty. The system helped cause the South to be the poorest part of the United States for many years.
The Reconstruction period changed the face of the South and the United States. The events of Reconstruction also were central to one of the nation's most interesting presidential elections.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.